podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Ever wonder what it takes to go from being an amateur to professional in sport? Welcome to An Athlete's Blueprint, the podcast that uncovers the secrets of champions, to let you know what it really takes to win a medal or break a record. Speaking to players and coaches, I capture insights from the training ground to the world stage, having the conversations normally kept behind closed doors. An Athlete's Blueprint is the podcast for sports enthusiasts starting out or those chasing the next podium. Get ready to rethink what you know about competing. Let's meet Daily Mail sports reporter Oliver Gamp. In this episode, we cover what it's like to report on a live event, handling interviews that go wrong, dealing with online trolls, women managing men's football teams, and a day in the life of a football reporter. Let's get started.
You know, as a writer for the Daily Mail, how do you make sure that women's sports are fairly covered?
I think it's just a case of covering them often and alert people to their presence. Because when I first joined the Mail, which was, I think, 2019, which was when I joined the online sector of Mail Online, we didn't cover women's football much. We didn't cover women's sport much. And it wasn't because we didn't respect it. It's just because it wasn't sort of a widely popular thing. And it was still up and coming. So we didn't, you know, if England women played, I don't think we'd even do a match report. Maybe we would, but it wasn't, we probably would do a match report, but only the big games, not the friendlies. And then a few years after I joined, we hired a women's football correspondent, my friend Catherine. And she's now the official women's correspondent for the paper and for online. So we created a role because it was getting such big publicity and it was getting very popular throughout the years. So slowly and slowly it's getting big. But yeah, to answer your question, we have just, as the years have gone by and as it's got more popular, we've just tried to cover it more. We tried to, you know, do features, previews to the big games in the WSL. I actually used to be a WSL reporter, so I used to go to Arsenal, Liverpool, Chelsea. I went down to the Audience Grounds, King's Meadow, which is where Chelsea play. And I've interviewed players like Alex Scott and some others. So yeah, I've always been interested in it. I've kind of seen the potential. But yeah, so at the moment we've been doing a lot of live runners, which is a live blog if you don't speak journalism lingo. So for the World Cup, for the Women's World Cup, we did a live blog for every single England game, which is not something we usually do. But we've been trying at the Mail to bring more awareness to women's football. So we did it for every single game. We did all the stories. When, who was it that got sent off? And it was a big controversy, Lauren James.
Mm-hmm.
So when she got sent off, we were really interested in it. It was big news. The news channel of Mail Online were interested. And when they're interested in something, it's big news because they get more hits than us. So when they want something, we want something. So there's kind of a link between the two there. So that's helped a lot. The fact that news are interested in all the women's sport and all the attention it's getting at the moment. So there's a women's footballer for Aston Villa called Alicia Lyman, and she's got lots of followers on Instagram and she gets a lot of attention. And she's a big personality. So we're covering her a lot. We do a lot of stories on her and the news page like her as well. So there's been lots of little things. And women's boxing as well is becoming very, very big. So we're doing a lot of stuff on the women's boxing. I went to Clarissa Shields against Savannah Marshall, which was a world title fight, massive one in England at the O2 Arena. I went to that and I was ringside for that. So that was really exciting. So the main thing is to do it more, so give it more attention and do more match reports, do more stories. And we've just done more and more as time has gone on, really.
So I want to, you know, you touched on a few things there. What's it like to report on these live events? Talk to me about that.
Yes, it's fun. So I've done a lot of live events during my time in the Mail. I've done the Euros, I've done the World Cup, I've done Tyson Fury's world title fights, Joshua, the Olympics, you name it, I've done it. So it's really exciting. You kind of feel like you're there, even though you're not there. So we tend to do them in the office. But it makes you feel part of it. The most exciting one I did actually was when Liverpool won the title. And it was during COVID and we were all at home. And I remember just the kind of like, you felt all of the adulation, all the joy, you know, I was gathering tweets and pictures from everybody who would mob outside the mob everyone outside Anfield. And it's kind of, you just have this like special feeling of being part of the event. And we do live blogs for all the big ones, and they're really popular. They get lots of views. And obviously there's a lot of people who don't have time to watch it, or they're traveling. And yeah, it's a really, really fun thing to do. It can be quite stressful. I mean, if somebody scores and then there's a VAR check and then there's an equalizer and then there's a penalty and then there's the sending off. If I take that Chelsea game, for example, their 4-2 win at Tottenham, when everything happened and there were so many incidents, that can be quite stressful. But that's the case if you're writing the match report at the stadium as well. But it's really, really fun. And you can kind of be creative. I don't know if you were like me, John. When I was younger, I used to watch the BBC football live blogs on a Saturday morning. Did you do that?
Occasionally, yeah.
So there was a guy called Jonathan Stevenson, who I really looked up to. He did all the live blogs for BBC. And he used to just have fun with it. He'd be like, oh, there's handbags and like, what's going on here? Like, he kind of put his personality into it. So I tried to do that as well. Live blogs are really, they're really, really good fun. And we get really good engagement.
And I think what would be really interesting to know for people is when you're at these live events, and I'm talking in person. So for example, I know that you've gone to the Tyson Fury press conferences and things like that. Talk to me about going to like a live press conference.
Yeah, the Tyson Fury one was crazy because there were so many people there. I went to the Tyson Fury against Dylan White one, and there were so many people there. The whole world's media descended for that. And there wasn't actually enough room for us all in the press conference room. This is very rare. This doesn't often happen because there was so much attention on it. I signed in. I was on the list. I got signed in and they put me upstairs. So the press I wasn't allowed in the press conference room, and they put me upstairs and we literally watched it on TV in this upstairs room, which was nuts. And I was very annoyed. I was like, I could have watched this on TV at home, and I'd come all the way to Wembley Stadium to watch it. And they put me upstairs. So that was a mental one where it was just so crazy. Luckily, they let me come downstairs after, and we were let out onto the Wembley Stadium pitch, and we got to interview fighters and promoters and stuff. It's really fun to be there. It can be exciting. It can be long. I went to a Floyd Mayweather press conference once, and he was an hour late. So I was just sat there waiting, talking to the fellow journalists. And you're kind of thinking, oh, when's he going to come? It's really exciting. And one of the things I really wanted to do when I was a kid wanting to be a journalist was the free food, because when you go to live events. So I went to my first Premier League game last year as a journalist, which is one of my life goals that I achieved. And when I was a youngster training as a journalist, I went to a Tottenham game. I'm obviously a big Tottenham fan, and I shadowed a journalist who was at Press Association, and he took me with. And I was just blown away by all this free food. So we went in, we had a roast dinner, and then there was a drinks fridge. You could have a Coke. There was a sweets pick and mix. And then at halftime, they gave you like a Chinese noodle pot in like, you know, those like cardboard boxes. And there was just all this stuff. And I was just like, wow, you get paid to watch football and eat free food. This is not a bad living. So I love all these events because you get free stuff, you get free food, and you get to watch a great game of football. So it's, yeah, that's great. And it's fun because after the game, you get to go, or after the fight, if it's a fight, you get to go to the media room and you kind of all huddle around the manager, or you go to the press conference suite and you ask questions. So it's the closest, what I would say is like when you go to these live events, it's the closest you can be to actually playing the game. Because obviously we all want to be footballers. Like if I told you could be a footballer, you would bite my hand off, wouldn't you? But we're not good enough to be footballers. So what's the next best thing is watching it and asking the managers questions and, you know, being part of the experience without actually playing. So yeah, it's really amazing.
So as someone who's as experienced as yourself, what do you do when interviews go wrong?
Oh God, yeah, I've been there. I was interviewing, I'll drop him right into this because it was bad. There's a boxer that you may or may not know called Jared Anderson. He's an up and coming heavyweight in America. He's potentially the next big thing in the heavyweight division in America after Deontay Wilder. He's a very talented boxer. He's got a good record. He's never lost. And I was asked to do an interview with him. Basically the first interview for Mail Online in the UK, kind of introducing him to UK fans. So it was, I'm kind of asking him, like, you know, why should we take notice of you? What makes you different? What makes you exciting? What can we expect when we watch your fights? How would you like people to think of you? And it was a chance for him to really sell himself and set himself apart and really make a statement. And he kind of just, he gave me nothing. He gave me really blunt answers. So I said, like, what are you, you know, describe yourself, sum yourself up as a fighter sort of thing, like sell yourself. And he just said, I'm just a fighter. That was it. He was actually just like, oh, I'm just a fighter, man. And I was like, okay. So it's like, in that situation, I probably should have been like, you know, expand. But it was so awkward that I kind of just went, okay, next question. And I'm kind of learning that now when people kind of brush you off to press them more. But at that point, I was a bit like, oh, God, I don't know what to say. And then I said to him, you know, how long and what would it take for you to get to the level of Fury and Usyk? And he said, I'm already there. That was it. He just said, I'm already there. And what I should have said was, you know, what makes you think you are there? You know, they're top dogs. They've won world titles. What makes you think you're at that level? Because probably not. And I kind of should have like taken him to task a bit. But that comes with the experience. So when stuff goes wrong, you learn from it and you look back on it. So now I take from that when someone gives me a blunt answer like that, I will push them a bit more. I've had it before. It's always boxers. Like boxers can be really amazing and really energetic, or they can just be like really, you know, they go into a shell and they kind of think they're too good for it. I remember there was a boxer called Shevin Clark who had just lost at the Olympics in 2020 or 2021 because it was delayed. And I kind of said, like, you know, the whole interview was talking about the defeat because it was like, you know, what have you learned from it? And he just said, oh, I don't want to talk about it. And I was like, yeah. I was like, you got to give me something, man. Like, you know, come on. I was like, come on. It must have been tough. It must have been disappointing. And he was just like, nah, I'd rather not talk about it. You know, it was what it was, and that's it. And I was like, oh, okay. So, yeah, that was a really awkward one. I'm lucky that most of my interviews, like, people have really come to the table. And because the whole point of an interview is that you're trying to sell yourself and you're trying to, you know, we're trying to write a story. So if you don't give me anything, I can't write a story. But yeah, luckily, most of my interviews, majority of them have gone quite well.
Wonderful answer. And I think as a fan of sport, we've all wanted to be in the press room and ask questions directly to a manager or a player or anything like that. What's that experience like?
So I used to get quite nervous. I say used to, I still get quite nervous because when you put your hand up and you get selected, all eyes are on you, including the manager. And then suddenly it's like, oh my God, am I going to get my words out? So when I was a trainee, I say a trainee reporter, when I was like up and coming, I used to do League Two games and I used to go to Barnet. And there was a manager called, I can't remember his name now, something Nugent. He doesn't really manage anymore, so he's not really a big name. But the Barnet manager, I literally used to be stood next to him as close as I could be to a friend. Just literally standing next to him. And I'd have my phone out, the voice recorder app, and I would always let the guy from the BBC ask the question. And I would just take his quotes and just write them up. And I was never brave enough to ask my own question. And then as time has gone on, every time I've gone to a press box or a media tweet after the game, I've always challenged myself to ask at least one question. And it's cool because you're kind of like, wow, this is a manager answering my questions. So it's fun. I went to the Southampton game recently, very close to you, John. And I asked Russell Martin a question, the Southampton manager. So yeah, it's cool. It's cool to like interact with people who you kind of see as, you know, famous. It's nice to, it's daunting, but it's nice. And it's challenging for someone like me, who's not a natural speaker and confident person. I've had to kind of do that as I've gone on, but interviewing helps with that. So I kind of just treat it as an interview when you're in a media room. You kind of just treat it as an interview, except everybody's watching and asking a question. It's probably worse if you were to go to Arsenal Tottenham and you've got Sky Sports, so they're filming it, probably that's even worse. But luckily I've gone to a few lower league games, and it's, you kind of get practice from doing that way.
And I think what I'd love to know is, can you talk to us about what happens, you know, the day of reporting, a day in the life of a, you know, a League Two football reporter? What, how does your day go?
Oh, God, I haven't done it for years, but I used to go to Barnet. So I would drive to the Barnet ground, which was called the Hive. And there's like a little bar there. I'd park up, I'd show my badge. I had like a little press badge. And I'd go in, I'd park up, I'd go to like, there was like a media suite, there was like a media center, and they would give you your lanyard. So you go in, you get your lanyard, put it over your head, and it has your face on it and says where you're from. And then you go in, you go to the bar, get a drink, probably not an alcoholic one because you're working. But there was like, at Barnet used to have like a little chicken shop, like a Nando's, like a knockoff Nando's. So you get your Nando's, and then you go out onto the pitch, and that's like a really... That's a really nice feeling. So Barnet didn't give free food. This was the bad thing about Barnet. But most places. So like, for example, I went to Stevenage and they had finger sandwiches, which is great. So they had a cup of tea, finger sandwiches. I went to Charlton also a few weeks ago and they made an effort. Like they had Scotch eggs and cocktail sausages. They literally just went and bought it from Tesco, but it was something, you know? So that's a nice touch. And it makes you feel like a journalist when you've got that kind of, you know, I always, no matter what it is, even if it looks terrible, I'll go get something. I'll go get a cup of tea. I'll go get a black coffee, because that's just part of the experience. And then you go onto the pitch wherever you are, and that's like a really cool feeling. And you go and find the press area. So there'll normally be like, you know, where you're at school and you had like a seat, and then the table flipped over the seat, and you put your books on it. It's kind of like that. It kind of goes up and up. So I've had times where I've been at a non-league ground and there's been no table. So you literally had to put your laptop on your lap. You're sat like on a little ledge and there's no Wi-Fi. So you had to hotspot off your phone and then just to send your match report. I've been there. But then you go to Tottenham and they've got amazing table, plug socket underneath. They've got a little, there's like a replay box, like a little TV showing you. So when the goal goes in, you can watch it back so you can write about it. But with League Two, you can't, like, there's, you have to just remember it. So I would turn to somebody else and be like, oh, who scored that? Who gave the assist? So yeah, it kind of varies, but yeah. And then the game will finish and then I'll go onto the pitch and interview the manager. So the interviews are done on the pitch. And you might get a player. And then I would send my match report. I'd write it up on the tables where the media tables are, and then drive home. Job done.
What are the nuances of interviewing a player and a manager?
I think the players probably have a little bit more personality. So, you know, they're a bit more, you know, freewheeling, easygoing, whereas a manager is a bit more PR trained. So if you ask a manager, like if I was to interview Mikel Arteta, for example, Mikel Arteta, unless he's been enraged by a VAR decision, he's going to be very blunt and kind of just like straightforward, you know, to the point. So he's not going to give me anything juicy or like interesting. If you watch Arsenal press conferences on the club's website, you know, the questions he gets asked, he gives a very basic answer. He'll say, you know, we want to get the 3 points. We worked really hard in training, this and that. Like he doesn't really give much away. Whereas if you get a player, they're a bit more emotive, aren't they? So like after a game, for example, you speak to a player and they're a bit angry about a VAR decision, because players, like managers, are more likely to get punished, aren't they, for speaking out against referees, whereas players, not as much. Or, you know, they don't care because they got so much money and they're not the face of the club, whereas the manager's the face of the club. So I think players and boxers as well. Boxers are very like, they don't care. They say whatever they want. Like if you see Anthony Joshua, he finishes a fight and then he'll just go off on a rant. Whereas a promoter will be very reserved and careful what he says. But yeah, I mean, you might, you know, you get a few managers like Harry Redknapp. You know Harry Redknapp. He'll come out, you know, the odd one-liner. Ian Holloway is very charismatic. Nigel Pearson. You know, Mick McCarthy. So you get different managers who have different personalities, and you have players who have different personalities. So you might have a player who's got nothing upstairs as well. So it depends. But yeah, definitely prefer to interview players. And if you're going to have to interview a manager, maybe a manager who's not got a job, because then they can kind of reflect a bit more and speak a bit more openly.
And how do you prepare for these questions that you're going to ask a player or a manager?
Yeah, preparation is really important. So when I've got an interview, and I've been given interviews, so my editor will say, "You're doing this interview." Sometimes I'll get my own interview, and sometimes he'll be like, "You're doing this interview," and it might be with somebody I've never heard of. So when I did the Jared Anderson interview, I'd never heard of him. But every time I'll get a notepad, I'll scribble down, I'll do some research, I'll spend about 20 minutes researching the guy. I'll write down this basic stuff, like I'll write down his age, his position, if he's a footballer, what foot he is, what club he's been at, who he's for, if he's a boxer, just like all of his basic record, so that when I interview him, I can say, "Oh, you did such and such last year, you did this time." And then I'll come up with some questions. I'll type his name or her name into Google and I'll press news, and then it tells you all the stuff that's been happening to them, which I think is a really, really good idea. So for example, today I interviewed Riyad Mahrez's wife, which was actually a new experience for me. But her name is Taylor Ward. I'd never heard of her. But she's going to be on a new reality TV show, basically looking at WAGs and the traveling around with footballers to different countries. She just went to Saudi Arabia. So I typed her in and I looked at the news stories about her, and I found out that when Riyad Mahrez left for Saudi Arabia, she was quite upset and she was shocked because he kind of just sprung it on her. And she was like crying, and he said, "It's part of the game, innit?" And it like went viral because he was so blunt about it. So I asked her about it and I was like, "Oh, you know, he must have been in trouble for saying that." And that kind of got a reaction out of her. So yeah, it's really important to research the person, research why they've been in the news, anything you can pick out. My dad calls these questions smoking guns. So it's like in a Western movie, someone's gun smoking, it's like someone's been shot. And it's like, oh, that's an interesting thing to pick out. So you pick out little nuggets of good topics to talk about. You come up with some good questions. And yeah. So never go into an interview unprepared, because you'll just end up looking stupid, and it'll get to 5 minutes and you'll kind of freeze and you'll be like, "Oh no, what do I say now?" So yeah, I try and have enough questions to keep it to at least 15, 20 minutes, depending. Sometimes I'm only allowed 10.
Okay. And, you know, you're someone who is in the public eye as a journalist, as a sports journalist, and we know the nature of sport. You know, one week you're celebrated, the next week you're condemned.
Oh, yeah.
How do you deal with the pressure of online trolls and things like that?
Do you know what I've done, John? So Twitter can be a very volatile place, as you may know. I don't think you go on Twitter very much now, but it's quite a volatile place and it's got a lot of trolls. So what I've done now with my Twitter, I've done a setting where you can only talk to me on Twitter if you follow me. So therefore, all the trolls are people who don't know me and don't follow me. So there was a few times where I written a story and somebody added me and everybody like reposted my story and said, "Oh, this guy, he shouldn't be a journalist. He's a joke." And I was like, "Hang," you don't know me. Why are you talking about me? You don't know me. You don't know what I'm like. You haven't read the rest of my articles. You're just judging me off one story. And I was like, why should I have to deal with someone who doesn't know me? So I was like, if anybody wants to like call me out, it can be people who actually are invested in my career. So there's a setting that banishes all those people. So you can only, you can still tweet me, but I won't see it. So it's hidden. So if you tweet me and you don't follow me, I don't see it. That has actually done the world of good for my mental health. So when I do a story, I don't have to worry about, like in the past, I'd finish work, I'd go make myself a cup of tea, and then I'd pick up my phone and I've got like a million messages on my Twitter saying like, "Oh, you're this, you're that, you don't know anything." And it used to really wind me up. And some people, you know, some journalists don't get affected by it. I kind of did. So that really helped me. But yeah, you got to have thick skin in the game. One time, a very famous footballer who I won't mention, a very famous footballer, right? I won't say where he played. I'm not going to name him because I don't want to shame him. But a very famous footballer called me a "see you next Tuesday." So we did a story about him. He didn't like it. And I was very shocked. So he DM'd me on Twitter. He followed me first. And I was like, "Oh God, I've really messed up here." And then he messaged me and he said, "You horrible, see you next Tuesday. How dare you write that on the, you know, on the mail." And he just, yeah, sent me this horrible message. Anyway, my boss got involved and they got into a back and forth. And yeah, that was tough to take. He ended up apologizing and he still follows me to this day, which is quite good. He's got lots of followers. So yeah. But yeah, so like that was tough. And I've had, you know, I've had other people call me out. I've had, you know, I've written a tweet and somebody said, oh, you look stupid. And then it's blown up and it's gone everywhere. And you kind of want to just like crawl into a hole for the day and just ignore it and try and get off your mind. But it can affect you. And I've actually brought this up with people and I've said, you know, we need more help as journalists. We need more support. And actually a friend of mine, a colleague, he did a story on Marcus Rashford driving into town the day after they lost 5-0 to Liverpool. Or was it 4-0? And, you know, we didn't make anything of it. It was just, you know, Man United player drives into town after defeat. And obviously the fans or the readers were a bit annoyed that we had, you know, said, oh, we've done a story on someone driving a car after losing a game. And yeah, he got pelters for it. He got absolutely taken apart. And I texted him. I said, are you okay? Like, that must be really tough. And he was like, I don't care. I was like, really? Like, that must be difficult to deal with. And he was like, no, I don't really get affected by this stuff. Like, I just find it funny. I like it. I enjoy it. And I was like, wow. So some people are wired differently. Some people can really just brushes off them. He might have been lying to me. I don't know. But I find it tough. But yeah, sometimes ignorance is bliss with these things. So you kind of want to just hide away from it. Not hide away, but just don't let it affect you by not bringing it to your attention. So if I can just banish it out of my mind, then it's fine. Sometimes I get emails from members of the public saying, oh, you call yourself a journalist, you're a joke. And that was because I put my email on my Twitter page, on my bio.
Yeah.
And I did that to make myself look professional. And, you know, somebody might email me a nice little tip off. But you know what? No one has ever emailed me a tip off. And the only reason people email me is to either send me PR stories I don't want or to. So my email went off my Twitter page very quickly after that. And now I don't get emails from people being horrible to me on email. So you can only email me if you know me and you've got a story for me. And you can only message me on Twitter if you enjoy my work and you respect me. So that's how I've dealt with it.
I think that's really, there's so much gold in that, because I think a lot of people, journalists experienced or coming up, or, you know, maybe they're at university or whatever, it's a really thing that isn't spoken about, like how to manage the public eye. And, you know, you're just, at the end of the day, you're just doing your job. And yeah, so yeah. Thank you for sharing that.
I had a blue tick on Twitter when they were attainable before Elon Musk took them all away. And it's exciting because you're like, oh wow, like that was another dream of mine to get a tick on Twitter, and I finally got it. But then with that tick becomes a heavy burden, so everybody expects you to be God's gift and know what you're talking about. And you know, I would tweet one thing and then someone would be like, oh, you call yourself a journalist. So yeah, heavy, what do they say, what are the storms you say, heavy is the crown.
Heavy is the head that wears the crown.
Yeah. So it comes with the job. And the problem is a lot of sports fans, not even sports fans, but just a lot of people who use the internet are just horrible. And they have nothing to do but to sit all day with their keyboard and write horrible things. And you kind of just have to say, like, I feel sorry for you, because my job is to write about stuff and you are wasting your time obsessing over what I've written. And it's just a job. So you have to keep calm and carry on.
Absolutely. And no, thank you for sharing. I think let's move on to another subject now. So you're a big football man. We've spoken about football already in this call that we're doing now. I'm going to put something to you and it'd be interesting to see what your thinking is. So given the position of women's sport and women's football, do you think soon we'll see the first sort of £1 million women's footballer?
Yeah, I think we will. I think we will, because I think Kira Walsh is the current record holder. She went to Barcelona for 750,000. We're not far away. And, you know, women's football is only getting more popular. It's only getting more lucrative. You know, we've seen all these English players go to Barcelona and foreign clubs. And these clubs have power. They have money. So, yeah, I think it's only natural that's going to happen, that's going to go to a million, probably more. I'd say more. I think, you know, women's football is only going to get, it's only going to go up and up, in the same way that men's football transfer fees have gone through the roof. I mean, you're never going to have a women's footballer who's going to go for 100 million. I mean, if that happens, I'd be very surprised. just because of the level it's at. But yeah, a million for sure, for sure. And I think that'd be a great day for women's football. But no, they're getting more and more recognition, deservedly so. And the quality is actually getting better and better. You know, I think there was a time when women's football probably wasn't at the level that you needed it to be for people to really stand up and say this is great. But I think the World Cup and the Euros before that, you actually saw some real quality and some talent. You know, really good skills, amazing goals. Like, we were doing a lot of stories in the Mail about some amazing goals that were being scored. But what we need is a bit more level playing field, because, you know, you'll see a lot of times England will beat somebody 10-0, or, you know, you'll see scores of like 14-0. And it's not what we want to see. I think it was more than 10-0, actually. England beat somebody and it was like a crazy score. And it was bad. It was a bad look for the women's game, because it shows that there's disparity between the quality. So yeah, what we need is more funding for other countries, not just England, Spain, but Brazil, Germany, America. We need more funding across the whole field, because you go, for example, Arsenal women went to Wolfsburg, and Wolfsburg couldn't afford VAR, so they didn't have it, and that was it, and that was okay. And then for the return, this was the Women's Champions League. For the return leg, Arsenal had VAR. And then at the Wolfsburg leg, there was a controversial incident where Arsenal felt they should have had a penalty and they didn't get it. And then in the home game, they had VAR. So yeah, something's not quite right there. So yeah, I think things will improve. We'll see things like that happening with the transfer fee. But yeah, that needs to come more level playing field.
I think that's a really good answer. And similarly, actually, same sort of topic. Do you think, you know, Emma Hayes gets a lot of credit? Could you see her managing a men's team one day?
Yeah, I could. Emma Hayes obviously won a lot of stuff. I think she's going to the USA national team now, which is obviously a huge opportunity for her. And she's getting noticed. And, you know, every time there's a job, especially the Chelsea job. She's been linked to the Chelsea job a few times, because obviously that'd be a huge step up. And I think that would shock the world if she took over at Chelsea, just because it's such a huge job. But no, it's not beyond the realms of possibility. I mean, Boris Green appointed the first women's manager, albeit very briefly. But they appointed Hannah Dingley at the start of the season, just as an interim boss. And everybody thought it was a PR stunt. But I spoke to Del Vince, who's the chairman there. And he told me she was the best qualified woman in the building. The best qualified person in the building. And they really felt that she was qualified to do the job. And then it turned out that somebody else more qualified than her came in. So yeah, it's not about, you know, whether a woman can manage a men's team. I'm sure they could. It's more just, are they qualified? And as the years go on, people will get more qualified. Emma Haynes, she could definitely manage a men's team. But our attitude has to shift as well, because there's obviously been a lot of misogyny from football fans. And I think the last thing you want to see is is a women's manager. I mean, men's managers get abused on the touchline at the best of times. So the last thing we want to see is a women's manager getting verbally abused on the sidelines. People shouting, you know, the things that we expect that they would get shouted at by trolls. So I think the attitude has to change for that to happen. But I think it could happen. And I think it probably will happen. I think a few years ago, there was a women's manager who took over a French football team.
Yeah, I think I recall that, yeah.
And I think that was quite brief as well. But I think, you know, we have to be able to be open to it as a society. And football fans, you know, every week you're seeing people getting arrested for racist abuse on the pitch. You're seeing people getting arrested for obscene tweets and racist tweets. And yeah, so we've had our first female referee in the Premier League and in the Championship. So do you know what? Things are progressing. Things are improving all the time. People are breaking their ceilings. So it's definitely possible. As women's football gets more publicity and limelight, that will probably allow it to happen in due course.
Thank you. In your experience, how surprised have you been with the rise of women's boxing and the attention it gets today?
Yeah, it's been really refreshing, actually. And I actually think women's boxing, you know, if you think about all of the women's sports around the world in terms of quality, I think women's tennis is the best in terms of top level quality. I think women's boxing is a very close second. Women's boxing has really come on leaps and bounds. And I was at the Clarissa Shields, Savannah Marshall fight. That was a world title fight, as I said earlier. And Clarissa Shields, she calls herself the GOAT, the greatest woman of all time. And she genuinely might be. And it was a real fight. It was a real scrap. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, I think the attitude of a lot of people is that women shouldn't fight and people want to protect women. But women are tough, man. And they really have a lot of skill in the ring. And it's not just, you know, it's not what the conception is. They work hard. They have proper trainers. So you take someone like Ebony Bridges. The difficult thing with women's boxing is there's a lot of glamour models now, a lot of OnlyFans models who get into boxing. And, you know, they're at the weigh-in, they're stripping down to their lingerie and they're trying to get attention. There was a girl who took her top off at the end of a fight and that got a lot of publicity. That's going the wrong way. And Eddie Hearn was talking about it. He didn't want to be associated with that. But Eddie Hearn, Matchroom Boxing Chief, he's been one of the biggest advocates of women's boxing. And every single show he puts on, there's a women's fight involved, at least one. So he's been really big on it. And it's getting really, really big. So Katie Taylor she's one of the biggest shining lights of women's boxing. And I think you may have seen she shared a screenshot of her message with Eddie Hearn when she was asking him to manage her. And she said, you know, I really have brought attention to the sport, to women's sport in the amateurs, and I believe I can do that in the professional ranks. And she did that. So she's become undisputed world champion. And she's taken boxing to new heights. She fought in Madison Square Garden against Amanda Serrano. It was this huge undisputed.
I remember that one.
Yeah, it was this huge world title fight and it got so many views and it sold out. Madison Square Garden sold out. And there was a huge interest in it. And it was this kind of amazing landmark moment in women's boxing where they kind of felt like they had made it. And that was really big. It felt like a proper fight, like a real, you know, not, I'm not going to compare it to Rumble in the Jungle, but it was that kind of moment for women's boxing. It was like they've made it now. There was so much interest, and at the Mail, we did loads of stories on it. But yeah, Katie Taylor is a really, really, really good example. So is Clarissa Shields. But it's getting big. It's getting really, really big, and there's a lot of attention on it. And I've done quite a few interviews with women's boxing stars as well. And you know, the thing is, they're not just, you know, working out for themselves. They are being hired by proper boxing trainers, proper boxing coaches who know their stuff, and they're seeing their talent, ability, and they're taking them on and they're making them better. So yeah, it's been really, really big, and yeah, it's a really, really nice thing to see. But the thing that kind of lets it down is, as I said, all these OnlyFans models getting involved in fights when really they're just doing it to get attention. And we want to see women's boxers fight for their talent and not, you know, showbiz. We don't want to see that. But no, it's a really, really exciting time for the women's game.
So looking ahead to the future, what's the big one for you? What have you got your eyes set on?
Wow, what a question. Do you know what? I've achieved so much already. I always wanted to work for the Mail, and I've done that. I joined through the trainee scheme in 2017. And I write for the company I want to write for. I just want to do more. So I've interviewed a lot of stars. I've interviewed, and I'll go like Tony Bellew. I've interviewed Joe Joyce, Jake Paul, David Seaman, Arnaud Danjumar, Bakary Sanya. You name the guy, like John Fury, Tommy Fury. I've interviewed so many big names, and I've been at Premier League game. I've been at boxing title fights. I've been to press conferences. The other day I had a sit down with Jermaine Genus, who was one of my childhood heroes. I interviewed Matthew Flamini, one of your childhood heroes. So I've done a lot. The thing I would like to do, and the thing that was always my dream, was to go to Champions League games and on a regular basis. So to do that, you have to be a very top level reporter. So at the moment, my job is to write generic stories about breaking news and things that go on in the Premier League and beyond and in sport in general. But what I would really love is to kind of be a roaming reporter. that goes, you know, every week I would go to a boxing press conference, or every week I'd go to a football press conference, and on the weekend I'd go to the match, and I do that every week as my job. At the moment I get to do that occasionally, but yeah, for me it's just more about doing more and more of that. When I was a kid, I set myself a task of going to the 2026 World Cup and being there that first day with my laptop doing the match report for the opening ceremony. And I thought to myself, if I get to do that, I've made it. So that's two years away now. So it's looking a little bit unlikely. But yeah, if at some point in my life I can go to a World Cup, I've made it. Maybe that was a bit ambitious, 2026. So that'd be really cool. Like, you know, being able to go to Saudi Arabia to cover a boxing match, that'd be really cool. You know, go to Las Vegas. I'd love to go to MGM Grand and do a boxing match report. That'd be really cool. So yeah, it's just to be at the biggest events and with the biggest sports personalities possible, and just enjoy sport and be part of it, basically.
Last question, by the way, I love that. Who's your dream to interview?
Oh, that's a tough question. Somebody asked me the other day, because I don't really get starstruck anymore. I've met a lot of sportsmen and sportswomen, and I don't really get starstruck. So like, I was in the room with Genius the other day, and I looked up to him as a kid, but I was with him in the room, and it was kind of just normal. It was just like some guy. But somebody said, "Who would you get starstruck with?" And I said, "Do you know what? If I was in the room with Harry Kane, I'd be a bit like." So I think I would love to interview Kane. I would love to, because I'm a Spurs fan and I idolized him as a kid. And I think he's an inspiration to a lot of people. And I think he is someone who I'd really like to speak to. The other person is Gareth Bale, for the same reason. When I was a kid, I had him on my shirt as the first player I had on my shirt. And I think he was an inspiration because he went from being a bad luck charm, if you remember, every game he played and we lost or we didn't win. And then he went from there to winning PFA Player of the Year, then went to Real Madrid, won the Champions League 4 times. And became one of the best players in the world. So I'd love to interview him on his career. And yeah, someone like Anthony Joshua as well, because I think he's got a very inspiring story. Those kind of the people who have kind of, you know, gone from rags to riches. Harry Kane is an interesting one as well, because he wasn't very successful when he was a kid. And he went on loan a few times. He went on loan to Leicester, to Norwich, and Leyton Orient. And he didn't really do that well. And there was a point where his career was kind of stuttering. And then he became one of the best Premier League footballers of all time, one of the best strikers in the world. So I think, yeah, I would love to interview him. I just love people with a story to tell. Like, for example, I interviewed a boxer who was working on the bins. He was a bin man. And now he is this big name on BT Sports or TNT Sports. There was another guy who was a teacher. He was working part time as a teacher, on the side while being a boxer. So I just love people with an interesting story to tell, and I just like hearing what people have to say, and people who, same as you, you like people who inspire, because sport can inspire so much. So yeah,
100%.
Yeah. So that's what I enjoy most.
Thank you so much. Like, you've gave a lot of energy. You know, there's things that, you know, I didn't even know about you, and yeah, it's been quite rewarding, this experience.
Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be on Athlete's Blueprint.
Thank you for listening to this episode of An Athlete's Blueprint. The authentic stories shared in this podcast aren't for everybody. They were just for you, a true sports enthusiast. Whether you're going into your next practice session or at the starting line for the finals, take the winner's insight from the athletes and the coaches you heard from today. Remember, this advice is only available on An Athlete's Blueprint podcast.
Sports Social Podcast Network.